This is Joe Alexander from Barely Human on YouTube, and you're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
I'm talking about a big coincidence.
There's the holy moment, and then there's the awareness of trying to have the holy moment. In the same way that the film is the actual moment really happening, but then the character pretending to be in a different reality. And it's all these layers.
We think everything is separate, limited. I'm over here, you're over there, which is true. But it's not the whole truth, because we're all connected.
The time as of now is now. And you are listening to Synchronize, the weekly audio magazine exploring and highlighting the best in the synchronistic arts. Please set your minds to open.
Open the floodgate doors.
Hello and welcome to Synchronize. This is Alan Abadesa Green. Many of you are aware that we just held an amazing event in Olympia, Washington, with guests such as Marty Weeds, Ezra Sanzerbell, Scott Onstott, James Evan Pilato, Will Morgan, David Plate, Steve Wilner, and Rodney Asher, amongst so many more. Ideally, what I'd really like to do is an episode of Synchronize that focuses on all the positive experiences there, the friendship solidified, and amazing feelings of community. To that end, I've begun editing video from the event and will be posting those regularly at thesyncbook.com/OLY2014. That's OLY2014. Patrick Sivek noted that there was a quality of the Olympia Sync Summit that felt like Woodstock. Then he goes on to point out that Woodstock itself was marred by the Manson murders the week prior. Our event coincided with the anniversary of Sharon Tate's murder, a detail no Sinkhead at the OLY Sync Summit missed. The band Negative Land, featured at Friday night's Radio 8 Ball show, even fits into this conversation with their Helter Stupid album and the way they toyed with Manson. Indeed, Manson and Tate, Her Zebra Rug, and Philip K. Dick's Zebra were high on everyone's radar. What we didn't realize was how heavily this entrained with the events unfolding in Ferguson while we were off having fun. While we were celebrating unity and community, an air of polarization was settling in across the nation. The black and white stripes of the zebra and Charles Manson's helter-skelter race war forcing itself upon the collective consciousness. Though today's episode may seem more political than synchronistic, I'd argue that this is the sync of the moment, which is a very unfortunate reality for those of us who want to stay positive, and even more unfortunate for those lives more directly impacted by the crossfire. Just as our Sync Summit began the same day Obama decided to go public with renewed bombing of Iraq and ended with the suicide of the Fisher King, Robin Williams, there was one other unpleasant and uncomfortable conversation taking place behind the scenes. Nearly all of the alternative media figures I spoke to in person, as well as in private correspondence, have been asking one question lately. What's the deal with Red Ice? For those of you who are not aware, Red Ice is a popular and influential media outlet in the alternative research field. Years ago, they pioneered a new form of podcasting that was not only slickly produced, the host and their interviews were beyond professional, and the content was incredibly diverse, ranging from politics to archaeology to consciousness, even putting Jake Kata and synchromysticism on the map in its earliest days. Yet in recent months, they have had a narrow focus, harping on racially loaded topics. This shift in their content has been so drastic that it is as shocking as it is undeniable. As someone who has appeared on their show twice, but much more importantly, as someone who has been a fan of theirs for so long, I am unable to stay quiet on the matter any longer. I could state my opinions or weigh in on the debate, but instead, I would like to open today's episode with this, an open letter to Red Ice. To Henrik Palmgren and the staff of Red Ice Creations. I write today as a longtime fan. I write from a place of respect for the incredible work you did for so long. I write from a place of gratitude for the researchers you've exposed me to, many of whom I am now lucky enough to call my friends, as well as gratitude for the platform you provided to synchromysticism, from the outset with Jake Kotz's work, all the way up to giving me a chance to promote the Sync book in recent years. Undoubtedly, a part of me also writes from places of sadness and anger and frustration and disappointment at what you've become. I cannot stress enough how proud a day it was for me when I was asked to appear on your show. Though it may sound silly to some, at the time it was something I seriously viewed as a life's goal, something I hoped and worked for. Such was the esteem, such was the high regard I held you in. Red Ice Creations has also directly influenced my own efforts with the Sync book. I was inspired to create a platform with the same ideals I recognized in your own. Non-censorship, objectivity, and professionalism. A place for open-mindedness and honest exploration. Yet there was something else you taught me about, the importance of discernment. For a time, you began your shows with a cautionary note, to be open-minded, but not so open-minded that your brain fell out. It was a warning of the intellectual traps and pitfalls that surround the deep topics we explore. This is a clip of something you said to me on that proud day when I was first on your show.
It's called being, in the truth lingo, if you will, waking up in one sense. But obviously, if you are stuck in one paradigm, it's just jumping from one box over into another box. You know, you haven't really set yourself free in that sense.
I ask you to look over the content you've been producing lately. Look it over with the discerning eye I once praised you for, and see if you can't understand why so many feel you've fallen into a box. Gone is the red ice of objectivity and possibilities. Gone is the sense of exploration. It seems all too clear that you found something. As a listener, I always caught myself wondering what you yourself thought. I assumed that so many years of exposure to and conversation with such high caliber guests that a mind as obviously sharp as yours, focusing on these issues for so long, would have an insight so unique and so valuable. Yet, when I see the chaotic state of the world, the wars and injustices, as well as the potential in untapped frontiers, that the topic you've chosen to focus all your effort on, that the most pressing issue in your mind, is that of race and ethnicity? At least Douglas Adams had a sense of humor about his anticlimactic bullshit answer. At the very least, as a source of information, Red Ice has lost its objectivity, and I hope you recognize the tragedy in that. At worst, if all our fears are accurate, you've succumbed to ignorance and a hateful collectivism. I want to believe you're more intelligent than this, but your position seems more and more solidified every day. It seems as though you've placed yourself into an intellectual and ideological box, one that is ugly and fearful and not even particularly interesting. And it is a box that I still hope you can climb your way out of.
This is Douglas Bowles from 42 Minutes, and you're listening to Synchronize with Andras Jones and Alan Green, a production of SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Oh, I see what you're doing.
Take two. Here we go.
Really?
I have to do a couple of these. I feel like a D-I-C-K for not... I mean, it was a couple of weeks ago that he asked for these from us, Will.
I sent one in.
No so way.
I did now. like a couple of times.
All right.
Joe's was badass.
Yeah, it was. This is what I'm like, the standard. This is Douglas Bowles, the Goblin King of Winter's Labyrinth, and you're listening to Synchronize, a production of SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
Back in July, SyncBook Press published Spilled Blood, A False God, and Real Estate, a new book both written and illustrated by Rabbi Baruch Goldberg. It takes a poetic but no less difficult look at the humanitarian crisis in the Middle East. Baruch appeared on the July 13th episode of 42 Minutes, an episode that was guest-hosted by Alan Green. Today, Alan and Baruch pick up where their previous conversation left off.
We've talked about the distinction between Zionists and actual, whether that be Israeli citizens or Jewish people of Jewish faith, things like that. But that's an important distinction to make on one level, and at the same time, maybe the more important distinction to make here is being open-minded to that distinction. We'll go one step further and make a distinction that, yes, while attacking the policies of Israel are not racist in and of themselves, that doesn't mean there isn't legitimate anti-Semitism and offensive. So that, you know, it's sort of like a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle is not a square. Do you know what I mean by that? Like saying it's calling out Israeli policies is one thing, once it gets lumped in as some sort of Jewish agenda or things that are straight up racist, can we find a way to talk about both and drawing a very clear distinction between those? And I'm trying to find a way to do that intelligently and delicately. Just as you can speak eloquently about the war crimes of Israel, how do we speak eloquently about the crimes against Jewish people? Both of these things are not in any way mutually exclusive.
Well, there's two things, I guess. I mean, the one thing I'm sort of concerned about, this whole Hitler thing. I don't know if that has some... I mean, I don't know if that's directed against Jews particularly, or if it's just people who like Nazis in general. Because I asked David to send me the link to the video. But I mean, if that's a current topic of conversation to people, I guess that's something of concern to me. Things like that, because that's not really anti-Zionism, I don't think. Or at least it goes quite a bit beyond anti-Zionism. It's difficult because there's so many people, especially in America, so many Jews who do identify with the state of Israel, that it's difficult to disentangle these two things for people outside of the community, you know? I mean, I can see how it must be confusing for people to distinguish between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism when often we're talking about the same people.
So how would you help us clarify that point?
We have to understand what Zionism is, maybe, that it's a nationalistic and imperialistic, I guess, political philosophy that was invented really in the end of the 19th century, and it was really patterned on German nationalism, and it sets itself up with several guises. You know, it has these disguises that it pretends to have its legitimacy based on the Bible or on Jewish teachings, but the authorities in Jewish religion were very opposed to Zionism up until quite recently. They didn't recognize Zionism as a legitimate expression of Judaism, and that the claims that Zionism makes have nothing to do with Judaism as it's been understood for the past 2,000 years at least. And in fact, the people that started Zionism were not religious or even identified as practicing Jews or people who believed in Judaism as a religion.
You've made the distinction that it's not a religious movement, or uses the guise of a religious movement. So then how do we help sort of distinguish for people who want to face Zionism, but often it seems to me begin to lump, and maybe this is my projection. You could tell me if you see this as well. Do you see people then begin to lump while trying to attack the Zionist movement? They end up lumping and attacking the Jewish people. Have you witnessed such a thing?
Oh, yes, a lot. And not only have I witnessed it, but the Zionists make a point of accusing anyone who criticizes them of anti-Semitism. So they confuse the matter further. So that doesn't help.
Sure, yeah. I think that's part of the ruse, right, to hide behind something. The deception seems to be working because I am witnessing a really strong backlash or violent and angry emotion being focused at quote-unquote Jews. And when pressed, they'll say, oh, we're anti-Zionist. But when people are saying Jews, to me, not only has the deception worked, but that person is losing some of the, you know, the credibility to say their argument is a subtle anti-Zionist argument. Well, certainly not if you are attacking Jewish, you know, people. Can you speak to any personal experiences you've had, either as someone who's been, as a Jewish man who's been outspoken against Zionism, or as someone who has, you know, sort of received both ends of this stick? So not just as someone who's outspoken against Zionism, but as someone who has received some sort of oppression simply for his faith.
Well, it's pretty mild. I mean, when I first moved here, I wasn't driving, but I was living about 10 miles south of here in Aptos, which is more of a suburban kind of place. And when I would walk about half a mile to the grocery store, almost every time young people would scream stuff out the windows of their cars at me. Just the standard stuff, you know, dirty Jew type, things like that. Occasionally throwing stuff, you know, tin cans, garbage, something. I mean, it never got dangerous or anything, but it was just one more thing to deal with, I guess. So after several months, I decided that it might be better just to start driving to avoid being a target like that. And that was just from walking around in a black suit and a hat, you know, and a beard.
Yeah, I believe ethnically I'm a Caucasian man, but I have darker
I have a darker complexion and a dark beard. And when I moved to North Carolina, I started experiencing just that, people driving past their car and screaming Allah Akbar at me, and, you know, all sorts of anti-Arabic slurs. Now, I'm not, they didn't even get it right. And but that's not the point. It's right, so, you know, this to me astounded me, what year we're living in, that this is still a very real experience for so many people. And mm-hmm. I think that's the really hard part about this conversation, is to acknowledge the reality of that there is an anti-Jewish backlash, there are anti-Jewish sentiments that pervade American society, or just, again, whether it's intolerance, because this is, you know, there's things done against blacks and done against whites and Arabs and so on, that this injustice goes wider than just any one group. But I think it's particularly hard when we discuss something like the finer points of Zionism. It seems to me that there is an almost a built-in linguistic trap there, that to try and approach this subject, there's a very delicate dance, because not only is it so easy to be accused of anti-Semitism, I believe it's also very easy to fall into, maybe even unintentionally, fall into a mindset of actual anti-Semitism, as I'm witnessing.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there's a sort of virulence about the state of Israel that seems to engender the same sort of response. I mean, it's so over the top that people seem to get over the top in responding to it, and it's getting worse. I don't know. I noticed a week or two ago that the Prime Minister of Israel was, when he was referring to the threat to the state of Israel, he said that 6 million Jews were under threat, which I don't know what the population of the state of Israel is, but obviously he was picking the number 6 million Jews to echo the number of people killed, the number of Jews killed in World War II in the Holocaust. I mean, that particular number has an immediate visceral reaction to a lot of people. 6 million Jews, sort of, people start seeing the gas chambers when they hear that number. So when people use such incendiary propaganda like that so casually, it's not surprising that things are so difficult, you know.
So maybe we can turn briefly to another type of propaganda. This we mentioned this idea of this 6-hour Hitler documentary. And this thing that comes up over and over again with the Elders of Zion, maybe you can speak. I know you haven't seen the documentary, but can you speak to this type of propaganda?
It's basically the premise that there is a secret ruling class of Jews that control the world, that Jews have amassed this great wealth, and they're behind all of the governments and banking institutions that all of these entities are really controlled by this secret group of Jews. It's an old idea, and you know, it goes back hundreds of years. I mean, although I think the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was written in Russia in the end of the 19th century, I think. But that sort of idea goes back farther than that. And certainly Hitler used that sort of propaganda as an as a reason that he gave to the German people for the state they were in after the First World War. The reason that they had no money was because the Jews took it all. And, you know, unfortunately, there were some large Jewish banking houses at the time, the Rothschilds and the Warburgs, to name a couple, which made the whole thing sort of credible to somebody who wasn't going to do a lot of thinking about it. You know, when people are in difficult economic times, difficult social times, like Germany in the 1920s or America in 2014, I guess people may be looking for a reason why everything is so screwed up, looking for the reason, looking for the villain. And we sort of traditionally made a pretty good villain for people to pull out of a hat.
You recently wrote a book, released by Sync Book Press, called Spilled Blood, A False God, and Real Estate. And one of the sort of opening salvos of your book is this idea of when the oppressee becomes the oppressor. Is it fair to compare the state of Israel to Nazi Germany in the scale of ethnic cleansing and things like that, and on that level, this is a question that's been raised recently, is that a fair comparison to make? And to what extent is that a fair comparison to make?
No, that's a comparison that a lot of people get very upset about when it's made. I think that may be looking at it in the wrong way. I don't know if any two oppressions are ever exactly the same. I think what matters is that the dynamics between the oppressor and the oppressed seems to be of the same nature, that it's dehumanizing, and it's that the Zionists are seeking to take away the humanness of the Palestinians. So whether the details are the same or whether the scale is the same, the sort of impulse is the same kind of impulse that's going on. It's a kind of action that uses the past as a justification for things which should never be done.
Moving forward into a space where these kinds of acts are never done again, one of the reasons that I'm really concerned with this turn towards using the Jewish enemy card, And again, this is making distinction here, the Israeli political establishment and Jewish people of the world, by seeing these things get so blurred, seeing that line get so blurred, what concerns me is this would be a way in which this can happen again. I'm concerned for all parties. As much as I'm concerned for the Palestinians in Gaza, I'm also talking about, you know, whether that be in Europe or America, here, where we have what I see as a very similar type of turn of events, blaming Jewish bankers, steering towards, you use the phrase dehumanizing. There are even some of these conspiracy movements that take the idea that there are space aliens that are posing as heads of government, and that in itself, I could be open to extraterrestrial life, but when I see those two ideas get put on the same table, it scares the hell out of me, because it's the ultimate dehumanization.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying, of course it's okay to hurt these people. They're not even human. Why was slavery acceptable here in the United States? We said blacks were only 1/8 human. Why was it acceptable to exterminate Jews? They're not even human. Why is it acceptable to obliterate Palestinians? They're not. This dehumanizing trend is what ultimately scares me.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you have any sort of parting suggestion of how do we maintain some sanity in all this?
I guess I can only speak for myself. I don't have any great solutions. I refuse to allow myself to be put into that sort of relationship with anyone where I'm treating them like a non-human, or they're treating me like a non-human, I guess. I mean, when all else fails, there's something very small about refusing to play the game that's put in front of me. I mean, it's not a... I mean, small in the sense that it's not a big political thing, but it's what makes me a human being, I guess, and that's what I have to keep doing. It's not going to change the world, I suppose, but it's all I can do.
No, don't sell yourself short. I think if we all remind ourselves constantly of our humanity, it goes a lot further to staying in that headspace, and I think that's a wonderful suggestion.
This is Michaela J., the voice of the corporation, and you're listening to SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
I suppose you're thinking about the cottage, Phil.
Yes, I did think about that.
So have I. You must know that. And it wouldn't work, Phil. It would just be too uncomfortable for Dave, knowing he'd moved into one of those neighborhoods. Darling, don't you see that? It's detestable, but that's the way it is. It's even worse in New Canaan. There, nobody can sell or rent to a Jew. And even in Darien, where Jane's house is and my house is, there's sort of a gentleman's agreement when you get
there. Gentleman's? Kathy, you can't... You're not going to fight it, Kathy. You're just going to give in. Play along. Just let their idiotic rules stand.
I don't play along. But what can one person do?
You can tell them to go jump in the lake. What can they do?
Plenty. Ostracize him. Some of the markets not deliver food, not even wait on him. The series will be over by the time we get there. Phil, face facts.
You expect us to live in that cottage once I know all this?
You can't make over the whole world. You know I'm on Dave's side.
Well, I'm not on Dave's side or any side except against their side. Kathy, do you or don't you believe in this? Because if you do, how can you talk about... Tom, will you please? Kathy and I are talking.
But, Pop,
Tom, what is it? What's the matter? Did you have a fight? Argument with one of the guys?
They call me a dirty Jew and a stinking kite. And you ran off at home. Darling, it's not true. It's not true. You're no more Jewish than I am. It's just a horrible mistake.
Kathy. Come with me, Tom. We'll talk about it in a minute. Water. Jimmy in it? Somebody sock somebody?
No, they just yelled. It was at our corner. Ron was a kid from school. They were playing hot, and I asked could I play too. And the school and said no dirty little Jew could play with them. And they all yelled those other things. I started to speak, and then they all yelled. My father has a long, dirty beard and turned and ran. Why did they, Pop? Why?
Adolf Hitler is still alive. I slept with her last night. Come out from behind that false mustache, Adolf. I know you're in there.
You're all a bunch of Jews. Andras Jones here. And that's what the hero and the villain in the movie in my mind says as he bursts through the church doors. My hero may look a little different than yours, but Joseph Campbell taught us that though he or she may have a thousand faces, it's usually the same hero. And in America, that hero usually looks like some cowboy version of Jesus, be it Neo or Luke Skywalker or Katniss. All symbolic sink associations seem to lead back to that magical murdered Jew who hangs perpetually at the heart of our mythologies. You see, to me, Christians are just hyper-reformed Jews. If you worship a thing, you become that thing. And I know a lot of you will say that you're not Christians, you're pagans or Buddhists or atheists, which is cool. I'm a little bit all of those too, but I loved movies and books and TV and music when I was growing up. I still do. And that means I've been indoctrinated with Christian, aka Jewish, mythologies without ever attending a Christian church, or even a synagogue for that matter. And so have you. It's in the cultural air we breathe. Abrahamic religions. Religious and non-religious Americans of all stripes are a kind of Christian, myself included. And to me, that makes us all a bunch of Jews. So, as a bunch of Jews just hanging out, talking sink, let's take a look at anti-Semitism, shall we? Your impulse about now is going to be to stop listening, and maybe to wish that I would just stop talking. This is what happens when Jews bring up anti-Semitism. It's not just Christians or anti-Semites who will try and shut you up. Heck, other Jews will sometimes come down the hardest on you. It's not like all Jews understand the workings of anti-Semitism. We feel it, we experience it. But I never got a grasp on it until I started working with reevaluation counseling and their very important work with oppression theory, which is based on the simple idea that society at large is oppressive to everyone's humanity, and, depending on the culture or constituency you come from, it hits you in particular ways. Now, even though I figure everyone who is a Christian, and remember, that includes all you Star Wars or Matrix fans, is a kind of Jew, not all of us are the targets of anti-Semitism. Imagine back in Roman times, Jews were crucified while Christians were thrown to the lions, or so the story goes. You see, different forms of oppression, but the result was the same. The house, in this case Rome, wins every time. American kids who weren't raised in explicitly Jewish households, where members of the family may have been victims of genocide, pogroms, blacklisting, and general old-school Jew hatred in the 19th and 20th centuries, may not have spent a lot of time thinking about Nazis. I mean, maybe you went through a phase where you stared into the dark history of fascism, but you probably haven't spent your life on a day-to-day basis with Nazis haunting your consciousness as the end result of every slightly or overtly anti-Semitic situation you encounter in the world. Perhaps this is an unrealistic view, and perhaps it is the most realistic view. My point in sharing it is that worrying about Nazis is as much a part of my experience as a Jew as anything else. In fact, as a secular American Jew, worrying about Nazis might be the most Jewish thing about me. And now, we here in the realm of Sync find ourselves embroiled with fears of, quote, white genocide and theories about a, quote, Jewish virus spouted from sources like Red Ice, a media organization we thought we could trust, with whom we thought we were in alignment. For most of us Jews, and I mean all of us Western Jesus lovers, it's disappointing and bothersome. For some of us Jews, and by this I mean the ones who would be killed if the Nazis were in control, the ones the Nazis consider Jews, well, for us, it's terrifying. And if I am to be honest, personally, a little gratifying and exhilarating. I mean, I've been preparing to fight Nazis my whole life, and here they are. And then, there's Israel. On the most recent episode, number 16, of Frater and Mater X's The Middle Chamber, I was invited to join a discussion of Red Ice with Alan Abadesa Green and Professor Jim Fetzer. The X's had intended to interview Henrik and Lana from Red Ice, particularly about their support for a film called The Greatest Story Never Told, which seeks to rehabilitate Hitler's memory. But the Red Icers dropped out at the last minute, and Alan stepped in on behalf of Sinkbook to fill the void. I had noticed with some confusion that Frater X had come out online in support of this pro-Hitler film, asking people to, quote, keep an open mind and to, quote, not kill the messenger. So when Alan said he was going to be on the show, I told him that was a conversation I'd like to be a part of. Unfortunately, before I could participate in the conversation, beyond making a general statement that I am opposed to Nazis, the professor began berating me about Israel. He insisted I agree with him that Israel is a genocidal nation just like the Nazis. When I wasn't ready to accept his simplifications and deliberately charged language, he became insulting, basically accusing me of supporting war crimes. I asked him why he was asking me about Israel, a country I have never been to, have no vote in, and am not an expert about. But the professor just couldn't see me as anything but a Jew, and therefore an agent, witting or unwitting, of Israel. Imagine a black American author being invited onto a show to discuss censorship, who is then asked to agree that problems in the Congo or Rwanda prove that black people are even worse than white slave owners, before he is allowed to engage the topic he was invited to discuss. That would be racism, flat out, and I think we could all see it. But when it's anti-Semitism, it's easier to not see. You see? I never really got to talk about Red Ice on that show. I'm embarrassed to say that I allowed the professor's bullying to cow me and shut me up on the issue at hand. And that, my friends and fellow Jews, is one of the ways anti-Semitism works. That's certainly what's been happening around the world with rising anti-Jewish violence from the UK to France to Italy to Germany to Turkey and even to Olympia, where the temple many of us walked by during the Sink Summit this summer was recently vandalized. The graffiti in Olympia was tame compared to the situation in Europe, where pro-Palestinian rallies have turned into attacks on individual Jews and Jewish organizations. It's hard not to see this projection of the sins of the Israeli government onto individual Jews around the world as a continuation of the centuries of attacks on Jews for other crimes we have not committed, like the pillaging of German banks, the murdering of Christian babies, or the crucifixion of that unfortunate radical rabbi from Bethlehem. There is a cultural impulse to punish Jews for our own sins, encouraged over centuries by churches and governments, and often by those we love. The actions of the Israeli government, disturbing as they are a convenient cover for that impulse, as demonstrated by Professor Jim Fetzer's behavior towards me on the X's show. For the record, the X's invited the professor back. But when I spoke openly in an online forum about my experience on their show, they mocked my experience in public, insulted me in private, and then blocked me. These folks, who encouraged us to keep our minds open to Hitler, killed the Jewish messenger pointing out anti-Semitism on their own show. This isn't a personal beef with the X's or even with the professor. Maybe they are anti-Semites, maybe they aren't. That's not a label I lay on people unless, like Hitler and his followers, they lay it on themselves. There is a difference, though, between being an anti-Semite and doing or saying something anti-Semitic. I'm a pretty sensitive guy, but I am a guy, and society is still pretty sexist, so I probably do or say at least one thing that could be construed as sexist every day. My intent doesn't really have anything to do with it. Just because I'm trying not to be sexist doesn't mean that I never will be. So when it's pointed out to me, I try and listen and potentially correct or amend my behavior based on the new knowledge. At the very least, gaining awareness of the way sexism works and taking responsibility for it makes a difference in what kind of a friend, coworker, neighbor, or fellow citizen I am with the women with whom I share the world. It actually behooves me not necessarily to think about myself as a woman, but to personalize the experience women share with me about how sexism affects them and how I might fall into perpetuating that pattern, just as I am asking you, my fellow Jews of all stripes, to do in relationship to anti-Semitism. Well, just as I was working on this piece and finishing it up, someone shared a video of the great Motown artist Smokey Robinson, who created songs like Tears of a Clown, Just My Imagination, and Please Mr. Postman, sharing a piece about being black in America. I'm going to close this offering with a selection that may frighten those of you who have put all your chips on saving the white race, just as much as it may trouble some of you to think of yourselves as Jews, even by my very broad definition. That's okay. One of the things Sink keeps teaching me is that sometimes it's good to meet the thing you've always feared.
Since those first ships arrived here from Africa and came across the sea, there were already black men in this country who were free. And as for those who came over on those terrible boats, they were called nigger and slave and told what to do and how to behave. And then Master started tripping, doing his midnight tipping down to the slave shacks where he forced he and great-great-grandma to be together. And if great-great-grandpa protested, he got tarred and feathered. And at the same time, the black men in the country who were free were mating with the tribes like the Apache and the Cherokee. And as a result of all that, we're a parade of every shade. And at this late day and age, you can be sure there ain't too many of us in this country whose bloodline is pure. But according to a geological, geographical genealogy study published in Time magazine, the black African people were the first on the scene. So for what it's worth, the black African people were the first on Earth, and through migration, our characteristics started to change and rearrange to adapt to whatever climate we migrated to. And that's how I became me, and you became you. So if we're going to go back, let's go all the way back. And if Adam was black and Eve was black, then that kind of makes it a natural fact that everybody in America is an African American. Everybody in Europe is an African European. Everybody in the Orient is an African Asian, and so on and so on. That is, if the origin of man is what we're going to go on. And if one drop of black blood makes you black like they say, then everybody's black anyway.
Well, let's bring Ezra Sanzer-Bell into the conversation. As many fans of Sync Book know, he's the author of Astro Music and a fellow musical diviner like myself, and he's here to help us with a little Radio 8 Ball musical divination for the question that we're going to ask.
Ezra, welcome to the show.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. So Andras and I have sort of thrown the idea of the question back and forth here. We realize that there's so much negativity here. We haven't denied the synchronicity. We haven't shut the conversation down, but we've certainly hit on a lot of negativity here. So we decided the question that we really want to ask is, in all the polarization, all the things we're hitting on here, all the things we're struggling with, what's actually good about this? What's the good side of all this?
And to engage the pop oracle, we are now going to go to The White Stripes, a band that resonates the zebra theme, which Ezra has been pushing for months and which definitely came to the fore at the Olympia Sync Summit. And we have 8 songs from their catalog chosen at random. And now we're going to choose one of those at random to answer the question. In light of all the ugly badness, the Nazis and the Mansons and the Fergusons and all the darkness that we're challenging in this episode, what's good about it?
That was the White Stripes with the song Little People from their first album, The White Stripes, from 2001. And that was the answer to Alan and my question in the face of all the ugly badness that we are addressing in this episode. What's good about it? Alan, Ezra, thoughts?
I'd love to jump in and just offer, maybe this can be a precursor to a more detailed discussion. One of the first things that caught my attention is that it's, you know, we're going back and forth between a little girl and a little boy. So there's a duality thing happening here. And when we talked earlier, Andras, you had mentioned the idea of either doing the White Stripes or the Black Keys. So, of course, as far as there's the piano joke and the zebra thing happening, the musical notes that were chosen here, those two chords we hear are an A major and a G major. And the melody's echoing that same thing. It's... And A and G are associated. A is Ayin, which is associated with the devil card, and G is associated with Nun, which is the death card. So we're going back and forth between the two, sort of, I'd say, the carriers of the shadow, as far as tarot is concerned. Those are probably the two darkest cards. But the question was, where's the good in all of this? So I think it's a pertinent question, given the key signatures that we're in. And I just want to point out that they weren't just A and G, but there was actually A major and G major. And a major is associated with the solar force in music theory, at least in the way that I conceive it. And so in the key of A major, which is the predominant chord of this song, in order for it to be major... to be a major chord as opposed to a minor chord, there has to be a C sharp as opposed to a C natural. And that C sharp note in relation to A creates this note. And that's that major interval which makes it positive. Well, C sharp is associated with Vav, which is the card, the Hierophant, or the teacher. So there's something in all of this that... for me, it's the idea that we're being invited to learn something. We are being instructed. And of course, in that image, we see the two monks being instructed. So there's a little girl and a little boy, or this sort of this polarity between the two students in relation to the teacher. So maybe that can be kindling for the fire.
That's so interesting, because I actually almost phrased my question as, what is the silver lining? And AG on the periodic table is silver, right? That's actually pretty hilarious.
That's great. Alan, your thoughts beyond that?
I thought it was fascinating that the thing that kind of keeps being repeated here is hello, hello, like shouting hello, and it's almost like it's an invitation to begin a conversation.
Right. I think particularly when we're addressing red ice, I think it's a natural impulse when you are at loggerheads with a person, with or an idea or people, to make them larger, you know, make them as large as your feelings, as the feelings they elicit in you. It's easy to think of, I don't think any of what we're doing is directed personally at Henrik or Lana. And yet at the same time, there are these two people who are representing this idea that we're opposed to, and the opposition, then it falls into a feeling of opposition with those people, and looking at them as a little girl and a little boy, and not in a way that demeans them, but in a way that I find that when I'm at cross purposes with someone, it helps to remember that they're just like me, that there's a child self in them that is probably psychologically wounded on some level and working out their stuff and has blind spots. And at some point was just a kid saying bing, bing, bomb or playing with spiders or getting excited about 25 cents. You know, at the same time as you could look at it in the, you could even project the bigness onto these lines, and bing, bing, bomb could be seen as a very aggressive thing to say. And a spider in your hand could be a very aggressive thing to have.
Sure, even the 25 cents. If you want to read into those lines, you know, I question, was this something they were doing purely as a sort of marketing tactic to create controversy around themselves and to make themselves the center of attention? You know, just one speculation there. But remember the question, I also thought while the song was going, little boy, little girl, I'm thinking Henrik and Lana, but maybe this is because this is where our minds truly are, but our question was not specifically about Red Ice, the question was in the context of Ferguson and Manson and all these other things included. So I was reluctant to, personally was reluctant to go down that route as the answer.
Right. Well, I want to jump in too, Alan, and, you know, just to stay on the Red Ice theme for a moment, because maybe in a way, since they're the closest to us in terms of, you know, the Sync community, many of us have been featured on that show. And so they're kind of, in a way, they're the perfect ink blot because we have some sort of personal connection to them. And, you know, in relation to the musical divination where C sharp or the Hierophant appeared here as the good element in all of this, if we're seeing the polarity between the two of them as these monks under the tutelage of the Hierophant, the question is, who's the Hierophant? And I would say, well, I think it's actually, in some cases, it might be the guests on the show. And where I would want to go with it is that one of the things that I've always really appreciated about Henrik and about Red Ice in general is that he feels so open to the suggestions of the people on his show. Not necessarily that he agrees with them completely, but that he's at least in a position of being open to their perspectives. And probably the most challenging perspective to be open to is one of just blatant racism. And so, you know, the interesting thing would be to go into then who are the individual guests and to really dissect their philosophies and look at them piece by piece. Until we do that, I don't think we can make any general statements about what's good about racism, because that in itself is a very challenging thing.
Sure. And there's this line in here that says, there's a little girl with the red shoes on. Now, we could see that as Lana sort of stepping into the administrative role on Red Ice. She's wearing the red shoes. But we could also endeavor to be the little girl and sort of walk a mile in their shoes, as it were.
In their Red Ice shoes.
Yeah.
Why are their shoes red? Why is the ice red?
Put on the red shoes and let's dance.
Click, click, click. Let's go home.
Yeah.
There's also the last line in the song is there's a little boy with nothing on his mind, which again brings me back to the idea that Henrik in a way is very open-minded. I remember I had a friend who was in college one time, and right when I was getting into synchromysticism, he told me, you know, I had a professor one time, he said, don't get too open-minded, your brain will fall out. And I wonder if this might be an example of that, of just being so open to any perspective that that, you know, the idea of like being of no mind, a Zen condition, is not merely to be impressionable and to take on the opinions of others, but actually to remain so open-minded that you can hear something without taking it as your own perspective.
Ezra, I don't know if you're aware, but there was a long period where Red Ice began their shows with that warning saying, be open-minded, but not so open-minded that your brain falls out. And I actually mentioned that in my opening piece to this episode, which you obviously haven't heard yet, but whoever's listening to this has heard. But yeah, I put out that idea that I think that's exactly what happened.
That's fascinating, because I never heard him say that, and I actually haven't heard any of these recent interviews that he's done, so that's why I was hesitant to contribute a more substantial piece to this episode. But that's just a trip that came out. I haven't even thought of that quote in years, and I think that's that's really a cue that we are, in some ways, there is some sort of subtle psychic network that we're all tapping into in this community. And that's one of the reasons that it can pose a real, I don't want to say threat, that sounds a little bit too severe, but when somebody starts opening up to these kind of ideas, it can seep into the larger collective and have real ramifications. So I'm glad that we're addressing it in this episode.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I always say about Radio 8 Ball is that it answers multiple questions. And before Alan and I settled upon this is the question, one of the questions that we were thinking of asking was, is it dangerous? Is what Red Ice is doing, is it dangerous? And is R responding to it? Is there danger in this? And so when you say that, you know, not that it's a threat, but there is something that is, whether you want to call it dangerous or not, use another word to describe it, there is something precarious about giving yourself to synchronicity, just as it is giving yourself to powerful shamanic medicines, just as it is, you know, probably dangerous to watch some of the TV shows that we focus on and find synchronicities in. And that danger is reflected in that quote of, you know, you want to be open-minded, but you don't want to be so open-minded that you lose perspective, that you lose context. And I think I would say that when you start blaming everything on an imagined other and projecting all that, then you have sort of lost the context that we're all part of the human family, even though that may sound trite, but it's the thing that we find in the realm of sync, is that we are all syncing on these different but similar things, or similar but different things, as in what just happened between you and Alan.
Totally. And it brings up the idea of magical realism for me, and just the, like Jung was really into this, that he said that there's a form of thought, I think Freud coined this too, but the idea of magical thinking, and they use that in a negative way, but they were saying it's a regressive way of seeing the world where you believe, it's a lot like solipsism, but it's even more overtly magical, where you believe that just by thinking about something, you can cause it to happen. And I think what our research as a collective has really shown us is that there's some element of truth in that. It may not be as cut and dry as I think something, therefore it happens. But I think in very subtle ways, we all are sort of receiver transmitters of this collective mind. And that mind, you know, it seems to be segmented off non-locally into different sectors. And as synchronistic investigators, we're all plugging into that. So again, to have somebody in our pod, if you will, bringing in these perspectives, as somebody personally who was raised in a secular Jewish household, I don't really identify as being Jewish per se, but certainly my ancestors did, and so it's not an irrelevant issue to me. And I look forward to having time to actually exploring this a little bit more and listening back to those episodes and seeing what's really been going on here, because it feels very relevant. I'm glad we're addressing it.
That was Radio 8 Ball, of course, with Andras Jones, and also guest Ezra Sanzer-Bell, who just launched the new website, audiomancy.net. Up next, we have a clip from last week's 42 Minutes, wherein Doug and Will continued their month-long look at Philip K. Dick's Valis, also known as Zebra, one of the topics we've been touching on tangentially throughout this episode. While speaking with philosopher and author Simon Critchley, the conversation turned to similar territory as what we are exploring here today, and provided insights that are definitely worth zeroing in on.
At the core of Bowie's music is the exhilaration of an experience of nothing and the attempt to hold on to it. But this doesn't mean that Bowie is a nihilist. Could you... So this is interesting to me in terms of that little book that we were talking about earlier, which is this idea where nihilism really becomes an important idea later on for the continental school of thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, nihilism is the idea that, you know, we have to, you know, we believe nothing, right? We believe nothing. We will deny everything. It appears in... Yeah, the great Russian novels of the late 19th century, Turgenev and Dostoevsky. And it's then picked up by Nietzsche and so on and so forth. And you know, it's the idea that the highest values, God, freedom, immortality, have devalued themselves, and we're left with nothing. Yeah, it's a position that was played out with great purpose by the Russ Cole character in True Detective earlier this year. He's a kind of voice for that that kind of nihilist perspective. He thinks there's like this whole monologue
he just sounds nothing but Nietzsche. It's like,
yeah, and some other things as well. But it's great. I mean, it might also be true in the sense in which, look at this world. You know, what sense does this world make? I don't know. And then you're inclined to think, did it make sense? Well, you know, when we had mutually assured destruction in the 1960s and 70s, although that was lunacy, at least it made sense. You knew there were these two people, there were Soviets and Americans, and they hated each other, and they're going to destroy each other. And then the world kind of fell into line along that crazy trajectory. Whereas now you look at the world, you think, what is this about? You know, and that now, the day before the 9/11 celebrations again, there'll be another speech by the president inviting, you know, Americans to support another foreign adventure in this, you know, in the same disastrous area that was screwed up, you know, because of what happened in 2001. It beggars belief, right? That this is even happening. And so, you know, to that extent, you're inclined to say with Russ Cole, no, it's nothing. This is nothing. And so in Bowie's music, you get that moment. You get that moment of kind of nihilism. But he doesn't leave it with that. He wants, like with Nietzsche wanted a revaluation of values, but to try and see through the crap and to see through the moral hypocrisy, in particular Christianity, and to find new moral sources that would be linked to art. And I think Bowie's in that kind of business too. So I think nihilism is a place you have to, it's an experience you have to go through in order to come out the other side. You know, it's not all abundance and growth. It's not all kind of, you know, spiritual karma and yoga classes and money making. And that is just, it's not Arianna Huffington. That's ideological crap. The philosophical task is just, you know, we have to begin by cutting through that, seeing ourselves as the moral hypocrites that we are, and seeing the world as the kind of crazy place that it is, kind of tearing that away, seeing it, and then we begin to rethink it in more honest terms. That's kind of, you asked before what I think philosophy is. I think philosophy is that, you know?
In terms of nihilism,
yeah,
and I don't actually know the history. Heidegger, was his response to that nihilism an embracing of National Socialism?
Yeah. I mean, it was in a sense in which, in that context, the ludicrous imperial ambitions of Kaiser Wilhelm, which had led Germany into the stupidity of the First World War, had come to nothing. And there was a sort of dysfunctional democracy in the 1920s in Germany, Weimar Germany, which was led to a massive economic crisis. And it led Heidegger stupidly towards an embrace of National Socialist ideology in the early 30s, as it did with a lot of other people. And I think that was a grotesque error, but I can see how it got to that. You know, it's the way that's usually argued is that, you know, Heidegger was a bad boy because he believed in Nazism and we should all become liberals or something. Whereas that's, you know, the problem that Heidegger was facing was that liberalism wasn't just not working, it was making things a lot worse. There was a liberal regime in Germany. It was completely screwing things up. So how does one respond to that? Well, you can respond to that in different ways. You can have you could purify liberalism, vote for Obama. You could move towards the extreme right, which is what's happening all across Western Europe right now, in Britain, yeah. Denmark, Netherlands. There's been towards right-wing populism, clinging onto forms of nationalism, or you could argue for a left-wing, you know, radical or revolutionary agenda. They're all responses to the same crisis that we're going through. So that doesn't exculpate. I mean, what Heidegger did was spectacularly stupid and naive and careeristic, but, you know, some of it was up, you know, in his context. And wow. And other people had exactly the same diagnosis, but they happened to be Marxists, and we sort of think, well, that was okay, whereas maybe that wasn't okay either. You know, so the sense in which Heidegger gets picked out for
he's on the wrong side of history, then maybe.
Yes, yeah, the wrong side of history, but I think that Heidegger is just the most interesting philosopher of the 20th century, because his philosophy is so powerful and his hands were so dirty. I think that's, for me, that's important. If you want, I think, I like the philosophers with dirty hands in a way, that there's a sense in which if we want our heroes to be clean, then we can find those. But there's something enormously powerful about Heidegger's work in the existential analysis of the early work and the history of philosophy, and it led him to make certain very stupid choices, and that there's a kind of lesson in both those things for me. We don't get clean hands.
To bring it back to True Detective,
True Detective, okay.
Yeah, because
it's fun. Lana Del Rey and True Detective. I love this.
We're with you, man. We run in the same house.
How much further can we take it down? It's great. What was interesting was the elaboration of his character and his interaction with the Woody Harrelson character. And to me, what Ross Cole was trying to be was he was trying not to be a moral hypocrite. That was really what it was about. I mean. And the other guy, Harrelson, was a moral hypocrite. He was cheating on his wife. He was a total fraud, leading this kind of family life with his commitment to the force and to the town and the neighborhood. And it was all crap. And Ross Cole was trying to live in the truth. He was the philosopher, right? He was the philosopher. He was someone trying to live in the truth and what that would take. Oh, it was just a fantastically rich portrayal. Also, I thought of his, you know, his sense of asceticism. You know, there's this ascetic side that he, you know, Woody Harrelson's wife, the character, seduces him, but there's no sex. There's a kind of monastic quality to him. And this obsession with finding out the truth, with detection. And there's a kind of purity to that, and I thought it was great to see that depicted on TV, and I think people responded to it because it's just true.
I'm Jake Kotza, and you're listening to Synchronize on SyncBook Radio from the SyncBook.com.
I actually think that went better than I think this turned out fantastic, a lot better than I there were moments that I didn't think was going to go anywhere near this good.
Yeah, I think that some people may think that we were too harsh, and some people think that we weren't harsh enough, but the synchronicities came out, and that's all that matters. That is the cue to say that, you know, right or wrong, we're on the right path.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said.
So we are going to go out on a song I recorded with Andy Shmushkin in LA while all this craziness was erupting in our world, not just online, but I was actually right on the perimeter of some real militarized LA police brutality during these sessions that I posted about at the time, and some of you may have read. You'll hear none of that in this song, which I think is actually kind of telling.
Yeah, I don't know, man. This is Sync. I could definitely hear all of that in the song.
Yeah, well, what about the piece you wanted to share?
It's just a piece that kind of came across my Facebook feeds, and it's interesting because I've been away from the computer for so much of the last few months, and particularly Facebook, and I've really only dipped my toe back into that world with this one thing kind of came across my feed and really stuck out to me. It's a gentleman who goes by the name Prince, and I'm going to spell this, Prince E.A. The second name is E.A. And you can find him on Facebook. If you haven't seen this already, it went fairly viral. He has a very active Facebook page. Please check it out. But this was just something where this is a gentleman talking about the situation in Ferguson, but not only trying to keep it positive, it's not even that. It's hitting at that underlying truth that I think we're all trying to really focus on. So it was just a beautiful, beautiful message. I hope everyone enjoys it.
All right, man, tell me what you just said, dude.
Yo, well, come on.
What did you just say?
All right, so we're talking about Ferguson.
Right, right.
Celebrities, politicians, activists, whatever. How do you fix Ferguson is the question, right? And we fix Ferguson in this, I gotta get to my car, man. So,
all right.
Yeah. We fix Ferguson in the same way we fix Afghanistan, Gaza, Palestine, Chicago, and that is to stop. We have to stop and be open to the possibility that we have been brainwashed on every single level of our lives. Brainwashed with conditioned thoughts, thoughts that we have fought over, died over, killed over, gotten angry, sad, and depressed over.
Okay.
We're so loyal to these thoughts, right?
Right.
But we got to question them, because they were created by the culture that we were born in. Look at that word, culture that we were born in, right?
Okay, all right.
This culture taught us that race was real, and we believed it. It taught us that war and violence creates peace, and we believed it. It taught us that love was weakness, and we believed it. We ate it up, right? But open any history book, right? Any history book, and you'll notice a trend. Generation after fucking generation, it's the same story over and over again. We've tried everything from politics to protests to rallies to riots to marches. None of it works.
Right.
These things create short-term results, not lasting solutions. And just because our parents or grandparents believed something or did something doesn't mean that we have to continue that cycle, man. Yo, this is our time right now. As I stand here right now, this is our time. Billions have come before us and billions will come after us. We have a chance right now to make a real difference. Or we could die doing the same thing that we've been doing over and over, expecting different results.
Right.
So the question then is, what have we not done? See, everybody's worried about changing this, changing that. What's on the outside, right? But we've forgotten about that which is looking outside, which is ourselves. Who are you, is the question. Right?
Yeah.
Who are you in the deepest sense? I'm not talking about your fucking race, your ethnicity, your heritage, your fucking ancestry. I'm not even talking about your experiences or your memories. Who are you in the deepest sense?
Okay.
Because figure that out. Because there will never be external peace if there is not first internal peace. And once you figure that out, I promise you, the entire world will transform, will change. And as more and more people find themselves, mankind has the opportunity to transform into kind man.
Right? Okay. All right.
So, you know, Jesus once said that forgive them, they know not what they do. And think about that. Forgive them, they know not what they do. They know not what they do because they know not who they are.
Okay. So, I liked it.
A lot of people, they won't understand the words that I'm saying. They'll they just won't hear it. They won't hear it. Some people will respond negatively. But for the few of you guys watching this, wherever you're watching this, I urge you to try it. Try to find out who you are inside of your body or what you are inside of your body. What do you got to lose? That's it.
I appreciate it, man.
All right, bro.
Kenny Loggins beard had a lot of songs in. Until he had it sheared. Since then he hasn't had a single hit. So auto-tune your voice and quantize your guitar. They say you got no choice if you wanna be a star. But if you're really smooth. You don't need a click track. What you trying to prove? Come on, baby, take your song back. Come on, baby, take your song back. Baby, take your song. Trying to prove. Come on, baby, take your song back and auto-tune your voice and quantize your guitar. They say you got no choice if you want to be a star. But if you're really smart, you don't need a click track. Drop the needle in the groove. Baby, take your song back. Baby, take your song back. Come on, baby, take your song back. Smoother than me. And I'm Andy Schmushkin.